said. I think it's time I went by Elsie again.
Chapter 20 The Netherlight Temple. Lu la lu, my dearest child. Lu la lu, lu la lay. Lordaeron says, go to sleep. Azeroth says, dream you deep. Lu la lu, la lu la lay. Safe in my arms, you'll stay. Kalia sang softly to the dreaming child she held. This precious little one would one day be heir to the throne of Lordaeron. No. No, there was no Lordaeron. Not anymore. There was only the Undercity, inhabited by the dead. Her father's crown had been broken and bloodied, and now it was lost to time. Kalia would never wear it now. This drowsing, dreaming infant would never wear it either. And that pained her. A single tear trickled down her face to land on the rosiest, softest cheek in the world. The child who was, by all rights, the true-born heir to the throne blinked, the small mouth forming a pout. Kalia lifted the bundle and kissed the tear away, tasting salt on her lips. And the baby laughed as her mother began once again to sing the old, old lullaby, glancing up as her husband came in to kiss the top of his wife's head. He placed his hand on her shoulder, giving it a gentle squeeze, the bony claw digging deep, and Kalia screamed. She bolted upright, her heart slamming against her chest, gasping for breath. For an interminable, horrible instant, she could feel the pain of the undead hand that grabbed her. Then she blinked, and the horror retreated into memory. She buried her face in her hands, realizing it was wet with tears, and tried to still her shaking. It was only a memory. It wasn't real. But it had been once. She slipped off the bed, reached for a robe, and then padded barefoot to Saara. No matter what the hour, there was usually someone about in the Netherlight Temple. Someone was always coming in or heading out. Those who made this place their home knew of Kalia's night terrors, and had made it clear they were available at any time if she needed company or to talk. But she only ever wanted to speak to Saara. The Naru was expecting her, as it always did. It hovered over her, a crystalline entity limned with luminous purple, and emitted a faint, ceaseless, exquisite music. Saara sometimes spoke in words that all could hear, and sometimes directly and privately to someone's heart and head, as it did now. Dear one, I am so sorry the dream has troubled you once more. Kalia nodded, sinking down in front of Saara and twisting her fingers awkwardly. I keep thinking that they will stop at some point. They will, the gentle being assured her, once you are ready for them to stop.
So you've said. But why can't I be ready now?
She laughed a little, hearing the petulance in her own voice. There are things you must do before that peace will be granted to you. Things that you must understand. That you must integrate into yourself. People who need your help. What one needs in order to heal will always come one's way. But sometimes it is hard to recognize it. Sometimes the most beautiful and important gifts come wrapped in pain and blood. That's not making me feel better, Kalia said. It might when you realize that all that has happened to you hides a gift within it. Kalia closed her eyes.
Forgive me, but it's hard to think that way.
The corruption of her beloved brother and the murder of her father, of so many of the people of Lordaeron, her flight, her terror, the loss of her husband and child, the loss of everything. No, not everything. What we participate in, we can benefit from. For every fever you have cured, bone you have mended, life you have improved, that, and the joy that has come from that, is now as much a part of you as your pain. Honor them both, dear child of the light. I would say trust that there is a purpose, but you already know there is. You have seen the fruits of your labor. Do not ignore them or belittle them. Taste them. Savor them. They are yours as much as anyone else's. Her tight chest eased as peace stole into her heart, Kalia realized she'd been clenching her hands, and as she unfolded them, she saw small red crescents where her nails had dug into the flesh of her palm. She took a deep breath and closed her eyes. This time she did not see the horrors of her escape, or more difficult to endure, the sight of her daughter at play. She saw only darkness, tender and soft. It gentled what was too harsh to bear in the full radiance of light. It provided safety for wild creatures and privacy for those who wanted to create, just for a time, a world with only two. Kalia felt Sa'ara's warmth brush her like the stroke of a feather. Sleep now, brave one. No more battles. No more horrors for you. Only peace and rest. Thank you, Kalia said, bowing her head. And as she padded back to her room, a hand on her arm, its flesh cool and unnaturally soft, made her pause. It was Eleanor, one of the Forsaken Priestesses. Kalia, she said. Kalia wanted nothing more than to sleep, but she had vowed to always be there for those who needed her, and Eleanor looked troubled. Her glowing eyes darted about, and her voice was pitched low.
What is it, Eleanor? Is something wrong?
Eleanor shook her head.
No, in fact, something might be going right for the first time in a long, long while. May we speak in private?
Of course, Kalia responded.
She brought Eleanor into her little alcove, and the two sat down on the bed. Once they were alone, Eleanor needed no further urging to speak. The words tumbled from her leathery lips so quickly that Kalia had to ask more than once for the Forsaken Priestess to repeat herself. Kalia's eyes widened as she listened, and her mind went back to what the Naru had told her.
There are things you must do before that peace will be granted to you. Things that you must understand, that you must integrate into yourself. People who need your help. What one needs in order to heal will always come one's way, but sometimes it is hard to recognize it.
Kalia's eyes filled with tears, and she hugged her friend gently. Her heart felt full and hopeful for the first time since Lord Aran fell. She now had a purpose. Healing had come her way. Gallywick's Pleasure Palace, Ashara. There were many places in Azeroth where Sylvanas Windrunner would prefer not to be. Gallywick's disgustingly named Pleasure Palace was not at the top of the list, but it was close. Once Ashara had been a beautiful land, full of open spaces and autumnal hues, and opening out to the ocean. Then the goblins had joined the Horde under Garrosh, and they had defaced the region with their trademark garishness. The palace, where she now sat in an overstuffed chair next to Jaster Gallywick's, had been hewn from a mountainside. The escarpment of the mountain had been turned into a literal face, so that Gallywick's grotesque mien leered over the wreckage of the land below. The palace itself was even uglier in Sylvanas' opinion. Outside was a vast green lawn with a course for some sort of game involving a small white ball, a huge pool with a heated area, and bartenders and waitresses currently standing idle, save for those who attended to Gallywick's. Inside was not much better. Tables groaned with food, much of which would never be eaten, and huge barrels served for decor. Upstairs was the Trade Prince's bedroom. Sylvanas heard it said that he slept on piles of money, and she was in no hurry to find out if those rumors were true. He'd been pleased to receive her message and kept offering drinks. She declined each time. While he indulged, she told him of the meeting at Thunderbluff, omitting the delicate threat she had given Bane, of course. She would give Gallywick's only the information he needed to know.
I trust that their efforts to heal the world will not damage your efforts to gather Azerite, she finished. Gallywick's laughed, ginormous belly jiggling, and sipped his frothy, fruity beverage. Nah, nah, he assured her, waving a big green hand. They can have their little ceremonies. My operation is far too vast at this point to be impacted. And hey, if it keeps them happy, that's the point, am I right?
Sylvanas ignored the comment. Your operation thus far has not yielded much that I can use, she reminded him.
Relax, he said. I got
people on it. Yes, I know.
Nah, seriously. I got the best minds I know of in a little place in Tanaris. Gave them a generous dollop of the golden goop. Told them to go nuts.
He took another swig and smacked his lips. And?
And they're working on it.
His gaze slid to the side. What exactly are they working on?
I told them they could do whatever they want, but you know scientists. They'll think of things you and I could never imagine. Best way to operate.
I want weapons, Gallywicks. He downed his drink and waved for another.
Sure, sure, they'll have weapons for us.
I want them to focus on weapons, or else I will send in every Forsaken, Blood Elf, Tauren, Troll, Orc, and Pandaren I can find and take over your operation. Are we clear? Sullenly, the Trade Prince nodded. Doubtless he knew she'd send her own people around to take the weapons that were made, whereas his scientists could craft other items he could sell on the side to make a tidy profit. A distraction for Gallywicks came in the form of a hobgoblin, who lumbered into the room and babbled something only his boss understood.
"Of course, idiot,"
the goblin said.
"Show Champion Blightcaller in at once."
Sylvanas thought she was almost as relieved as Gallywicks at the interruption. Nathanos entered, gave Gallywicks the barest minimum of a nod, and bowed to his queen.
"My lady," he said, "forgive the intrusion, but I thought it best to bring you this missive immediately."
He knelt before her and held out a scroll. It was sealed with blue wax and stamped with the head of a lion.
"Oh-ho! I know that seal!"
Gallywicks exclaimed, then sipped his banana cocktail. Sylvanas knew it too. She tore her gaze from the scroll and impaled the goblin with a cold stare. "You will excuse us," she said. He waited for a moment. When she continued to sit, raising a pale blonde eyebrow, Gallywicks made a face and heaved himself out of his chair.
"Take your time," he said. "I'll be in the hot tub if you want to join me when you're done with this fella."
He waggled his eyebrows, then trundled out.
"Hey, honey bunny, bring me a pineapple punch, will ya?"
"Sure, boss,"
a squeaky goblin female voice replied. Nathanos's red eyes were fixed on the Trade Prince's retreating form.
"I will kill him," he said. "Oh no, that pleasure will be all mine."
Sylvanas got to her feet and gazed down at the scroll he held.
"So, this is from Varian's whelp, given to you at the Undercity?"
Nathanos's face was unreadable.
"Yes, hand-delivered to me by Archbishop Thau. He's now a Forsaken."
Sylvanas let out a short, sharp bark of laughter at that.
"His light works in strange ways."
"So it would seem."
Sylvanas broke the seal and read.
"Unto Queen Sylvanas Windrunner, Dark Lady of the Forsaken, and War Chief of the Horde, King Anduin Lane Rin gives respectful greetings. I write to you with a proposition that has nothing to do with armies, territories, or goods, but it is one that I believe will serve both the Horde and the Alliance. I will cut directly to the heart of the matter. When you approached the Alliance, seeking a home for your people, you were refused. We were still reeling in terror from what Arthas had done to Lordaeron, and couldn't understand that your Forsaken were truly different. I have spoken recently with a Forsaken who is greatly respected in life, and have learned that despite all he has endured, he still follows the light. His name is Alonsus Fowl, and he was once Archbishop of Lordaeron. He has agreed to be a go-between in the interest of helping both the living and the undead. This missive is about families. Families that were torn apart, not by Horde and Alliance, but by Arthas, who rained despair and devastation upon all of us. Spouses, children, parents, so many separated, divided first by death, then by fear and anger. Perhaps if we can work together, those driven apart can at last be reunited."
Sylvanas stiffened. Oh yes, she more than anyone understood about divided families, slain loved ones. She had lost everything because of Arthas, her friends, her family, her beloved Quel'Thalas. Her life, her ability to care, truly care, truly feel any emotion save hate and anger about those things. And she had attempted a reunion, had accepted her older sister's offer to call what Arthas Menethil had left of her family together, to reclaim Windrunner Spire and purge it of the dark things that dwelled in it, and perhaps to purge themselves of their own darknesses by harking back to a time when there were no shadows within them. But it had been a futile endeavor. Suns and moons they had been when they were young, bright Lyria with her gleaming golden tresses, and laughing young Lyrith. Sylvanas had been Lady Moon, and Verisa, the youngest of the three sisters, had been Little Moon. Verisa was bowed and sullied with grief for a lost love, the death of her husband, Ronan and Theramore, one of so many victims of Garrosh Hellscream's mana bomb, had shattered her. Shattered her so completely that for one lost, lonely, lovely moment, she had turned to her shadow sister Sylvanas, and they had plotted together. Verisa had come so close to joining Sylvanas in the Undercity. So close to joining her in Undeath. But at the last minute, love for her living children had eclipsed Little Moon's grief for her dead husband. And so Verisa had stayed with the Alliance, and Illyria, thought lost for so long and then miraculously returned, had invited the unfathomable darkness of the void within her. It granted her powers and strength, but it changed what she looked like as well as who she was becoming. Sylvanas knew enough of what such powers could do to recognize the mark of cold fingers on Illyria. As for her own shadows and darkness, Sylvanas knew them well enough not to examine them now. The boy king's plan was a foolish one. He still believed that people could change. Oh, they certainly could. Illyria, Sylvanas, and Verisa were all proof. But it was not changed for the better. At least, Anduin would not see it that way. Why was she so angry? The pup got under her skin so much more than the wolf had. She returned her attention to the letter. We are not currently at war. But I am not so naive as to believe that means hostilities do not still linger. We have experienced recent tumultuous change to our very world in the form of Azerite, a manifestation of the pain Azeroth herself is feeling. With unity, we could direct our exploration of this substance in ways that can save her. Let us therefore focus on a smaller but no less important gesture of unity as a first step toward a potential future that benefits both the Horde and the Alliance. I propose what amounts to a single day of a ceasefire. On this day, those families who have been divided by war and death will have a chance to meet with the ones they lost. Participation will be strictly voluntary. All those on the Alliance side will be thoroughly vetted, and no one who I believe would be a danger to the Forsaken will be allowed. I would ask the same of you. We will determine a limited number of participants. A site suitable for this event is the Arathi Highlands. I will have my people assemble at the ancient fortress of Stromgard Keep. Thoradin's Wall is close to a Horde outpost. There, in the open field, with sufficient protection as agreed upon by the two of us as leaders of Human and Forsaken, these ruptured families will meet. It will last from dawn until dusk. With your agreement, Archbishop Fowl and other priests will facilitate, assist, and offer comfort as needed. Should any harm befall my people, be certain I will not hesitate to retaliate in kind. Also, I understand that should my people harm any Forsaken, you will do likewise. As a priest, as King of Stormwind, and as the son of Varian Rin, I will guarantee safe passage to the Forsaken who choose to be involved. If this ceasefire is successful, it could be repeated. Do not mistake this for an offer of peace. It is only an offer of a single day's compassion for people who were cruelly torn apart by a force that was neither the Horde nor the Alliance. You and I have both lost family, Warchief. Let us not force that upon others, who, like us, did not choose it. Done this day by my hand. King Anduin Lane Rin. He is even more foolish than I thought if he believes I do not see right through his trap, Sylvanas said, crumpling the letter into a ball. What do you think of this Archbishop Fowl who gave you the letter?
He is indeed Forsaken. He seems genuine. Though when I suggested he pledge fealty to you in the Horde, he demurred. He said he preferred to serve the Light rather than kings or queens.
Ha!
Sylvanas said without humor. I liberated him to be a Forsaken so that he could have free will, and thus I am repaid. No matter. I take it you believe he is harmless?
He is powerful, Dark Lady, but he is no enemy. He also brought a letter for the head of the Desolate Council.
Sylvanas tensed. I see that the king's spies are hard at work if Rin knows of the council. Rin. For so long it had meant Varian. Strange.
Possibly. We must remember that many of our number move freely in the Netherlight Temple. Besides, the letter he sent to her did not even mention the council. It turns out that until very recently, Elsie herself was among the number of Forsaken who had living family. Her husband, Will Benton, served both Varian and Anduin Rin.
Elsie?
It was the name Will had for Velsinda, and she's reclaimed it now, Nathanos explained.
The majority of Forsaken had taken new given names or surnames for themselves. They did so to mark their rebirth as Forsaken, to cast aside their old identities, and bind themselves together as a unified group. Sylvanas was surprised to find that her chest ached to hear that Velsinda had rejected her Forsaken name. Velsinda was a name with dignity, gravitas. Elsie was, well, evocative of what the woman had been in life, most likely, common and ordinary. And human. Sylvanas focused on the other piece of information her champion had given her. This plan of Anduin seemed suddenly much less strategic than personal if he had lost a devoted servant, which made it much less threatening. Even so, Velsinda likely served the royal family as well. Sylvanas would not dignify the Prime Governor's new offensive name by utilizing it.
Yes, she worked in the kitchens, Nathanos continued. She was saddened to hear of her husband's passing. This proposition meets with her approval, as she believes that she is far from alone in retaining fond memories of family members.
Sylvanas shook her head. This ceasefire is a mistake. It will only lead to pain for my people. They cannot be human, and to dangle this temptation of reunion with loved ones will result in them growing discontented with who they really are. Forsaken. They will deteriorate to heartbroken shells, wanting something they can never have. I have no wish to see them suffer so. Again, she thought of her own attempt at connection with the living, and how all it had done was stir up old ghosts best left resting in peace.
You could use this to your advantage, Nathanos said. Velsinda said that many Forsaken wish their next death to be their last death. They do not wish to keep existing. And one reason commonly cited is that they want to be with those they loved while they lived.
Sylvanas turned her head to him slowly, considering his words.
If you authorize this experience, this reconnection with people they loved in life, and present it to them as something that you have generously granted them, perhaps they will be more amenable to accepting your solution, finding ways to keep the Forsaken as a race from going extinct.
It is fraternizing with the enemy, Sylvanas said, letting them interact with life and the living.
Perhaps. But even so, it is only for a single day. Give them this hope, this moment with people they thought they'd never see again. Then
I hold the power to their happiness, at least in this aspect, she finished. Or they might decide they hate the living and be all the more devoted to their Dark Lady. Either way, Sylvanas would win.
He nodded. At the very least, it will demonstrate to them that you are listening to their concerns. I truly believe the Desolate Council to be ultimately harmless. They're not radical traitors. Give them this chance, once. If you see benefits, you can determine if you wish to repeat it.
You make a good argument. She unfolded the crumpled missive and read it again. It will be difficult for my archers to stay their hands with so many humans in front of them.
They will obey you, my queen, Nathanos said.
It was the truth. Her Dark Rangers would never loose an arrow without her orders, and Sylvanas was not ready for a war with the Alliance. Not over this, at least. She made her decision. I will accept this invitation on behalf of the Forsaken. Return to the Undercity. Inform Velsinda Benton that her queen is sympathetic toward her desire, and will be visiting her to discuss this gathering in more detail. Have her begin compiling a list of those members of the Council who have living relatives in Stormwind. Get their names and information. I will give that list to Anduin, so that he can locate them and determine if they too wish to participate.
There are more than just the council members who would like to be involved, Nathanos said. A great many attended the memorial service and are sympathetic to them.
But Sylvanas shook her head. No. This needs to be a small number so I can control the situation. Council members only.
As my queen wishes. If I may speak freely, I believe you have made a wise decision. From all that I have seen, I believe this will quell any rumblings of discontent.
One way or another, it will, she smiled coldly. It could also pave the way for claiming Stormwind. I had thought that an attack would be the only means to take it. But if the young king trusts us, we could one day soon pass through those magnificent gates to a friendly welcome.
Her thoughts once again went to the astonishing substance that was Azerite. What it could do, what it could create, what it could destroy. Chapter 21 Tanaris. Shortly after Safi had agreed, of your own free will now, Grizzik had emphasized, to assist him in plumbing the potential of the magical, marvelous, miraculous Azerite, Gallywix had sent them a single large vat of the stuff, along with a note. You two creative kids go crazy. The first experiments had covered the basic steps, identifying the material's properties, testing it under various conditions. Exposed to sunlight and moon's light, sealed away, exposed to air, immersed in various liquids, including acid and other highly dangerous chemicals. That had been Grizzik's favorite part so far. During one such experiment, Safi noticed that the thick, tar-like substance of a deadly poison they'd smeared on a sample chunk had changed color.
Will you look at that?
She said. Quickly, she grabbed a vial of the antidote and set it down within easy reach. Then, before Grizzik could even yelp in surprise, she'd extended a hand and touched the discolored poison.
Safi, no!
He surged forward and grabbed her arm with one hand and the antidote with the other.
Hang on a minute, Safi said. This stuff should be eating my skin away by now. But look, I'm fine.
They both stared at the poison on her hand, then at each other.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained,
Safi muttered, and she licked the stuff off her fingers.
Grizzik uttered a strangled cry. Safi smacked her lips.
Astounding! This highly poisonous corrosive substance now tastes like sunfruit and cherries, she said. Maybe it always tasted like that,
Grizzik offered. His voice trembled a little.
No, it's supposed to be completely tasteless. Yeah, whatever. Just don't do stuff like that, Safi, okay?
She looked at him and saw that he had gone pale. He had been worried about her. Not just worried as in, oh, I'm going to lose my lab partner worried, but worried as in... Safi couldn't let herself think about that. They had work to do. Bringing back old feelings would only be a distraction. They'd always done better as lab partners anyway. She returned her attention to her hand.
This is important, Grizzy, really important. Long term, who knows what this stuff can do? We've just seen that it can neutralize poison. Bet it can heal wounds, too. Maybe it can extend life.
She shook her head in disbelief.
What a gift! Come on, back at it. There's so much else we need to know.
After they'd done everything they could to test Azerite in liquid form, next up were tests to determine if once it had hardened, anything could break it. Nothing could. Not a sword, or a hammer, or a goblin shredder, or even a device Grizzik had named the Crunchola, which he demonstrated to Safi. It was a modified shredder, but one of its mechanically operated limbs was outfitted with a grasping hand augmented by an energy beam.
The idea, Grizzik explained, is that the energy pulse increases the pressure, so it's 7 times as strong as the usual hand. That's an odd number, Safi observed, perplexed. It is.
It took her a second, then she said flatly.
I meant odd as unusual. Why not 10 or 15? He shrugged. 7 is supposed to be lucky.
She rolled her eyes. They scooped out a pail of liquid Azerite from the tightly sealed vat Gallywix had provided and placed it to harden in the open air. The substance slipped out easily once it set and was surprisingly light. The Crunchola, or Crunchy as Grizzik, who seemed inexplicably fond of the thing, dubbed it, grasped the chunk of Azerite in its lucky 7 energy-enhanced hand.
Grizzik threw the switch. The Crunchola squeezed, tight, tighter. And then Grizzik shrieked in dismay as its four digits snapped.
"Your hand!" he cried. "Oh, Crunchy, I'm so sorry."
Safi looked at her notes and crossed off test number 345, Crunchola, and wrote down Azurite 1, Crunchola 0.
"One resource we do lack is a mage," Safi commented, peering at the unharmed, pale-shaped Azurite. "It would be fascinating to see how this is affected by magic." "If you really want one to join us, I can ask Gallywix."
Grizzik didn't sound so keen on it, and Safi stiffened at the thought.
"Maybe later. Right now we have a good rhythm going with just the two of us."
She was surprised that she was saying it, but it was undeniably true. The thought of a third party entering their lab felt wrong somehow. Grizzik seemed to brighten at her words.
"Yeah, we do,"
he said. He climbed out of the Crunchola, patting its arm sadly.
"I'll fix you up, buddy,"
he promised. Then he took a deep breath and turned to Safi.
"Magic can be phased too," Grizzik said. "Let's exhaust our own resources and imagination first. Give Galley Boy a baseline for what we can do with pure science."
Safi giggled.
"Galley Boy?"
Grizzik scratched his enormous nose and chuckled a bit.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Silly, but the guy bugs me so bad."
"I think it's perfect," Safi announced. Their eyes met, and Grizzik's expression was unguarded.
"You do?"
he asked, surprised.
"Yep,"
she replied.
"Pompous airbags sometimes need the occasional sharp poke. Deflation is better than exploding." "For him or for us?" "Oh, for him, definitely. I don't care if he explodes."
They laughed together, just as they had in the old days, in that narrow band where everything had been perfect and they'd been crazy about each other instead of being driven crazy by each other. "Watch out, Safi," the gnome reminded herself. "Don't jinx this. It's all going too well for things to turn bad."
"We've gathered a good baseline on the nature of the substance in isolation," she said. "I'll compile my notes, and then we can move on to see what happens when we try to shape it, or manipulate it, or combine it with other items." "Oh, we should do wearable items."
"Like rings or necklaces?"
"Yeah, Galley Boy inadvertently gave me the idea. He used the first known chunk of the stuff as an ornament for his cane. We can experiment with it and figure out how to make amulets, rings, and other trinkets with it. Think we can mix it with other metals?"
"We'll find out."
That was her specialty.
"But first I better compile these notes."
But Grizzik was shaking his head.
"Nope, those can wait. Go outside, clear your head."
"I never go outside."
"I know, but you oughta. Moons will be out here soon. Go on, scram. I'll handle dinner."
It was not said unkindly.
"Do you still burn things down when you cook?" she asked.
"Not so much these days."
He made a shooing motion. With a shrug, Safi ambled out to the beach. She was not alone, of course. Gallywix's goons were stationed all around the enclave, and even patrolled the beaches. But they kept their distance, and didn't bother her or Grizzik too much. He'd put out a chair, and there was a table. An umbrella was up as well, not that one needed it at this hour. As Safi settled into the chair, she had to admit that the sky was absolutely glorious, and the moon's light on the ocean was astonishingly soothing. Safi usually took a while to wind down when her brain was percolating briskly. She heard the noise of something clattering behind her, and turned to see Grizzik balancing a tray in one hand and lugging a chair with the other. He didn't say anything as he plunked the tray down on the table and pulled up the chair.
"Wine?"
Safi said, startled.
"You poured wine."
"Yeah," he grunted. "Had a bottle somewhere. I knew you liked the stuff."
He hadn't really cooked, which was probably why the place was still standing. He'd just reheated some seafood stew she'd made for lunch and grabbed some bread. They ate in silence, listening to the sound of the sea. Safi was thinking very, very hard, and not about Azurite, though that did want to sneak in around the corners of her pondering.
"Grizzik,"
she said.
"Yeah?"
"When I first came here, you called me by my nickname."
One of them, at least. They'd had several of them over the sliver of time when things were going well. Their marriage had been, well, as short as they were. They had been lab partners first, and that had gone well. But then they'd been stupid enough to fall in love with each other. The first month had been glorious, the very epitome of a great love story. and then it had fallen apart just like one of Grizzik's faulty and poorly designed contraptions. Suddenly, everything one did irritated the other beyond tolerance. Many things got thrown or broken, and once Safi had found herself shouting so loudly that she lost her voice. That had been a horrible day. Grizzik had felt free to taunt her, and she couldn't shoot back a pithy retort. But not even the unpleasantness of that dreadful time seemed to encroach on their collaboration now. They worked together almost seamlessly, listening to what the other said, offering suggestions, forming a true partnership. Safi was loath to admit it, but the last few weeks working alongside Grizzik had been pretty good. Wonderful, actually. That in itself was almost as unbelievable as the strange material she and her former husband had been working with. She heard him sniffing and clearing his throat.
"Yeah," he said. "I guess I did call you Pumpkin. Sorry, I guess."
Safi sipped her wine and thought some more.
"It's been good these past few weeks."
"Yeah, it has.
It reminds me of old times," she said cautiously.
"Me too,"
he said quietly. She wanted to ask 1,000 questions.
"Do you still miss me? Why do you think we don't hate each other anymore? Is the Azurite affecting how we feel about each other? Can we only be all right when we're working? Would it be a mistake to try again?"
Instead, she said,
"This Azurite, it's pretty amazing. Could help a lot of people."
"You're a genius, Safi. An absolute genius. You're going to make such things.
And you, Grizzy," Safi said enthusiastically. "Your robots and your launchers and those little one-person airships. The Azurite's going to help with all that, too."
"You think so?"
"I know so."
"Safi, we're going to make this world sit up and take notice, you and me. The sky's the limit."
Slowly, her heart beating as fast as a rabbit's, Saffronetta Flivers slid her hand across the table and felt Grizzik's big, green, calloused paw close around it. Gently, protectively, as if it was the most precious thing in the world. And Safi smiled. In between kisses and canoodling, the reunited, re-involved pair got a staggering amount of research done. They mixed the Azurite with a variety of different metals and even used it as paint. They made pendants, rings, bracelets, and earrings, and they made armor. It was ugly, goblin-designed stuff, but it wasn't meant to be pretty. It survived 3 solid minutes of bombardment from the reconstructed Lightning Blast 3000. The only damage was a slight melting of the metal. All of this had required only a small amount of Azurite. Then Safi decided to go full gnomish alchemist. She began to experiment with potions. With a single drop of one on Grizzy's completely smooth green pate, he grew a luxurious mane of thick, glossy black hair that flowed down his back.
"Ah!" he yelped. "Cut it off! Cut it off!"
When a drop of poison was mixed with heated Azurite, a result similar to the earlier experiment in which Safi had licked off poison was achieved. When she poured the mixture on a struggling plant, the palm tree doubled in size.
"That's a high ratio of Azurite to poison," she mused. "Let's see what happens when we switch the proportions."
"Careful there, Pumpkin," Grizzik said worriedly. "I only just found you again."
Safi's heart warmed, turned over in her chest, and turned to mush. Figuratively, of course. She went over and kissed him soundly.
"I'll take every precaution and then some."
He hovered anxiously as she prepared the poison, then offered to be the one to mix it with the Azurite.
"Oh, Grizzy, you're so sweet. But you don't know exactly how much I used."
Sticking out her tongue in order to concentrate better, Safi poured the precise amount of Azurite into the beaker of poison. There was no visible change to the substance as she swirled it gently to mix the contents. Then she took a deep breath and poured a single drop on the plant. The reaction was immediate. The plant went from the almost absurdly healthy, vibrant, emerald green color to first sickly yellow, then black. It drooped, completely dead. They stared at it, then at each other. They said nothing. Safi tried it on another plant, but this time, before the poison's effects had visually manifested, she clipped a segment. The pair of scientists pressed their heads close together as they watched the section rot right before their eyes, as if every fragment that made up the plant had been targeted instantly. Safi spoke first.
"Let's increase the amount of Azurite."
As she was doing so, feathers flew into the room and circled their heads.
Big ugly guests! Big ugly guests!
It squawked. They looked at each other, wide-eyed.
I hope it's not Gallywicks, Grizzik muttered. Hopefully it's just the goons. I'll get rid of them. Be right back.
Safi's eyes followed him as he left. She had never before regarded just the goons as a hopeful phrase, but the alternative would be far worse. They weren't prepared to demonstrate anything to the leader of the Bilgewater Cartel goblins yet, and to say that what they'd just witnessed made her uneasy was as much of an understatement as saying the sword of Sargeras was a knife stuck in the ground. She took a moment to jot down her notes, cataloging the precise ratios, then doubled the amount of azurite in the deadly mixture. She'd just poured a dollop onto another plant with almost identical results when Grizzik returned. His normally healthy emerald green coloring had paled to a sickly chartreuse.
You don't look good, Grizzy, Safi murmured.
Well, he said heavily, I got good news, and I got bad news. The good news is that it was indeed just the goons.
Safi let out a breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding.
Thank goodness for small favors, she said.
Bad news is, Gallywicks wants a demonstration in 2 weeks. And,
Grizzik added heavily,
he wants us to focus on weapons.
Chapter 22. The Undercity. Harqualf and Talas stood with the other members of the Desolate Council for what he hoped would be its most productive meeting yet. This time, he stood a step lower than he usually did, as did all the members. The Prime Governor herself stood not on the topmost stair, but one step below it. This time, someone else, someone who should have been at every single meeting of the Council, would finally be present and occupying that place. Archbishop Fowl, who had become a regular at the Undercity over the last few weeks, stood beside Elsie. They put their heads together and talked quietly. The room was filled to capacity. Those who drew breath doubtless would have difficulty doing so in this room. Parqual was well aware that although some of the Forsaken had dried out rather than decayed, most of their number had been raised while they rotted, and the smell could not be a pleasant one. Elsie was smiling. So were most of those assembled. They were excited to be present for this meeting. Parqual was glad too, but was not as hopeful as they were about the end results. He and a few others wanted to move much faster than patient, forgiving Elsie did. He did not expect Sylvanas to move at a rapid pace, but he was willing to listen to what she had to say. All at once, the room went quiet. Parqual turned and saw the figure of Nathanos Blightcaller standing in the doorway at the end of the long corridor that led into the large room. Nathanos waited for a moment, then announced,
Queen Sylvanas Windrunner, War Chief of the Horde, and beloved Dark Lady of the Forsaken, has arrived.
A cheer arose, not as lively as an orc's bellow or as sweet as a hurrah from a blood elf, but as genuine as it could possibly be coming from dead throats. And then, she was there. Even here, in the safest place in the world for her, Sylvanas Windrunner had chosen not to shed her armor, Parqual mused. Did she simply never remove it? She stood straight and tall, unlike so many of those who adored her. Beautiful still, whereas they had been ravaged by death and rebirth. Then she inclined her head in acceptance of their adoration and strode with a smooth, elegant gait toward her place as Queen of the Forsaken.
I have missed this place, she said as she looked around fondly, nodding to a few individuals she recognized. And I have missed you, my people. The orcs, blood elves, trolls, tauren, goblins, and pandaren are worthy and loyal members of the Horde, but they do not have the unique bond that you, the Forsaken, and I do.
There was a rumble of appreciation for the acknowledgement. With other races, it would be applause and stamping of feet. The Forsaken, however, had learned it wasn't wise to unduly wear out their appendages prematurely with such gestures. Clapping was terrible for the hands. Sylvanas looked down at Elsie.
Prime Governor, I hear from my loyal Nathanos that you have taken good care of my realm in my absence.
Elsie inclined her head and bowed as deeply as she could.
Only because you were absent, my queen. We are dearly glad that you have come back.
Only for a few hours, unfortunately, Sylvanas said. The regret in her voice sounded sincere. But in that time, I hope I will be able to settle some things that will please everyone here. She looked out again at all of them. I understand that the Prime Governor has also received a letter from the King of Stormwind. He proposes a day's ceasefire in the Arathi Highlands in order to hold a gathering of Forsaken and humans. Families or friends who have been separated by the slaughter that took place in this city only a few years past. Sylvanas turned her crimson gaze to Archbishop Fowl. Archbishop Fowl has been speaking both to him and to the Desolate Council. What are your thoughts on this, Archbishop? Fowl didn't reply at once. He looked out at the gathered crowd, then back at Sylvanas.
You can trust King Anduin, Your Majesty. He means no ill. I know from my conversations with the Prime Governor and others in the Undercity that all those here today, and more than a few Forsaken who could not be present, are in favor of this gathering. It remains to be seen if the human half of this plan is also amenable. If they are, I and another priest from the Conclave would be honored to supervise the event.
Excited murmuring swept through the hall. The Dark Lady paced back and forth for a moment, considering. Or pretending to consider, Parqual thought. She already knows what she will do. This moment is for our benefit. Finally, she stopped and faced the throng. I will permit this. A cheer went up. Not a murmuring of approval, but a genuine cheer. Even louder than the one that had greeted the Dark Lady. Sylvanas let her lips curve in a faint smile, then lifted her hand, calling for silence. But I must above all ensure the safety of my beloved Forsaken, she said. So here is what I will say to the king when I reply. Each member of the Desolate Council will submit 5 names, in order of preference, of people in Stormwind they would like to meet. If these individuals are still alive, they will be contacted and asked if they wish to participate. The king and a priest selected by the good archbishop will permit only those whom they deem sincere to attend. I will tell him that his people may assemble at Stromgard Keep. On the selected date, we will fly to Thoradin's Wall before dawn. Champion Blightcaller, I, and 200 of my finest archers will be there, in case the human king decides to betray our trust. It was possible. It was unlikely from this king if half the things Parqual had heard about him were true. But it was indeed possible. And he had to admit, Sylvanas's words were a comfort. 25 priests will be mounted on bats and actively patrolling the field. In case of an open attack, teams of my Dark Rangers and others will be sent to defend you. I will allow the king to field a similar number of priest defenders, although I do not expect any member of the council to initiate hostilities. It was a lot to protect 22 Forsaken. But Parqual was highly aware of the significance of this meeting, as clearly were Anduin and Sylvanas. At sunrise, you will walk forward to a halfway point that will be marked by Horde and Alliance banners. Archbishop Fowl and his assistant will meet you there, as will your Alliance counterparts. Parqual had thought he had passed beyond the ability of such things to cause deep emotion, but apparently not. Filia? Would they be able to find her? Would she want to come? What would she think if she did? He was suddenly acutely aware of how bent and twisted his body was, of flesh that stank, hanging off exposed bones. Would she be horrified? No. Now that the possibility was manifesting, he realized he had wronged her by fearing her revulsion. Not his Filia. He was quietly certain of that. If his heart could still beat, it would be racing with excitement. He felt a gentle touch on his right shoulder and turned to Elsie. She was smiling for him. Oh, Elsie, if only your will had lived just a little bit longer. But Sylvanas, apparently unaware of how profoundly her words had affected him and others, continued. All participants will be allowed to remain on the field until dusk. At that time, you will return to the wall and the humans to Stromgard Keep. She paused again, scanning the crowd. Obviously, what I have just said assumes that everything goes smoothly,
there is a chance that it will not. If I perceive any kind of danger to you, my people, I shall immediately order a retreat. A forsaken flag, not a horde one, will fly on the ramparts of the wall, and the horn will sound. If the Alliance decides to order a retreat, the same thing will happen, except they will fly the Stormwind flag on Stromgarde Keep and sound their own horn. If either horn is sounded, you must turn around and return to the wall at once.
Her voice cracked like a whip and echoed in the vast chamber. The effect was chilling, and the crowd was utterly silent.
Now then, are there any questions?
Parqual steadied himself and raised his hand. The glowing red gaze fell upon him.
Speak, Sylvanas said.
Will we be allowed to exchange anything?
Exchanges of trinkets will be permitted in the following manner, Sylvanas said. Prior to the event, anything you wish to give to your counterparts will be examined. There will be areas on the field where they may be placed on tables when you reach the meeting site. The Alliance will do the same. Do not touch anything they have left on the tables while you are on the field. At the end of the day, these items will be collected and gone through to ensure they are safe and contain nothing seditious. They will be distributed to you at a later date. The Alliance will, I hope, do the same with your gifts.
Our Dark Lady is most generous, Parqual said.
Sylvanas inclined her head.
I take it you have an item you wish to share.
I do.
He thought fondly of a toy Philia once had loved. She had left it behind when...
Then it is my sincere hope that the Alliance does not decide to throw it away, Sylvanas said in that soft purring voice.
It was a cruel thought, and Parqual did not like to entertain it.
Any other questions?
Another hand was raised.
May we touch them, our loved ones?
You may, Sylvanas replied, although I cannot guarantee that such a touch would be welcome.
Again, an unkind thought. Doubt stirred in Parqual's mind, but he forced it back. Not his Philia. He had hoped hearing from his leader would make him feel better, but instead, he felt unsettled and unhappy. Others seemed to feel that way too. And then he understood. Sylvanas did not want them to do this, but she couldn't come out and simply forbid it. There were too many of them. Their ideas were spreading. Even people like Elsie, who were completely loyal to the Dark Lady, who loved her. Even Elsie wanted to take the Forsaken in a different direction. So Sylvanas was doing what she could to rob them of any little pleasure in the planning. Suddenly he saw his queen in a new light. He saw many, many things in a new light. As if reading his mind, Sylvanas said,
I realize I do not sound optimistic. That is because I am not. I confess to you now, I wish you would not do this. Not because I would deny you any joy, but because I would not see you hurt. You are ready to embrace your living relatives, but do they feel the same? What will you do if they do not wish to see you? If they think you abominations, monstrosities, instead of the remarkable, courageous Forsaken that you are? If I am cruel, it is only to be compassionate.
Everyone knows that, my lady,
Elsie exclaimed.
Thank you, Prime Governor, Sylvanas said. Are there any more questions?
There had to be, but no one was daring to ask them, and Parqual thought he had drawn enough attention to himself.
If there are not, Prime Governor, I have some for you. Will you join me later to discuss them?
As my queen wishes, Elsie said.
She turned to the crowd.
Everyone, I hope you share my pleasure and anticipation of the coming reunion with our loved ones. I would like to thank Warchief Sylvanas again for permitting this to happen. It is my fondest wish in the world that this goes smoothly, so that we may see our friends and families more in our future. For the Dark Lady!
Another cheer went up, and Sylvanas smiled fleetingly, then stepped down off the dais. The crowd of Forsaken parted for her. The cheering continued until Sylvanas, flanked by two Dark Rangers, disappeared into the corridor. Parqual turned to Elsie.
You seem a little melancholy, he said. I thought you would be happy.
Oh, yes, I am. I do admit I'm feeling just a bit sorry for myself, though. I wish I'd been able to see my will, to show him that after all this time, I still have my wedding ring.
Surprised, Parkwall glanced down at her hand. She chuckled.
Oh, no, of course. It doesn't fit on my finger anymore. My hands are too bony, and I wouldn't want to risk losing it. But it's safe and sound in my room at the inn nonetheless.
He thought of Philia.
Elsie, I'm so sorry, he said.
She waved a hand.
Don't you worry about me. I've had more luck and love than most. Will's legacy will be that many others are going to be able to experience something wonderful thanks to him. It's all right if we two didn't get to have it. One can't have everything.
She leaned in conspiratorially to Parkwall and whispered,
Even so, I'm going to loop the ring on a chain and wear it to the gathering.
Somehow I think he'll know,
Parkwall said, and meant it. Chapter 23 Stormwind. Anduin had frankly expected either an immediate refusal from Sylvanas or a dragged-out back-and-forth communication chain. To his pleasure and surprise, the Horde leader had replied promptly that she was indeed interested in supporting his proposal. But, Sylvanas had written, we will start with a small, well-vetted group. I will not risk tempting the less noble among your people to assassination. There was a second letter, too. This one had cemented the rightness of his decision in his mind, and it touched his heart as well.
Dear King Anduin, thank you for taking the time to write so kind a note informing me of my dear Will's passing. He was terribly fond of your family, and it pleases me to know that the boy he took care of became the man who comforted him as he left this world. We all will die eventually, even we forsaken. It moves me more than you might imagine to know his last thoughts were of me. He has never been far from mine. Archbishop Fowl has been a very kind presence here, and I write today not only to thank you, but to let you know that all 22 members of the Desolate Council gladly accept your offer to meet with our loved ones who yet breathe, if they want to meet with us. Our beloved Dark Lady has asked each member of the Council for 5 names to submit to you. This way, if one person is no longer living or doesn't wish to attend, there are other options for reunions. As for me, I've no one left that I know of to meet during this gathering of the living and the undead. Will and I weren't young when death parted us, and most of our connections were with the royal families and servants. If pressed, I would say I should very much like to meet you, to express my gratitude in person. But I would understand that such a thing would be far too risky for you. Even suggesting this gathering shows much courage, and I commend you. Know that your letter is now one of my most cherished belongings, such as they are, second only to the wedding ring Will gave me so long ago, when we were both young and happy, and the world was full of hope. Thank you for making it full of hope once again, if only for a single day. With respect, Elsie Benton.
Anduin felt himself smiling. It faded as he mentally acknowledged that there were others who, though they would certainly be surprised by the pair of responses, would not be at all pleased. A knock on the door brought him out of his reverie.
Come in,
he called. He braced himself for another scolding from one of his advisors, but was surprised when the guard opened the door and Kalia Menethil entered. He rose and went to her.
Kalia, he exclaimed. It's good to see you. To what do I owe this unexpected pleasure?
He had been working at a table and now pulled up a second chair for his guest. She slipped into the proffered seat.
I reached out to Lorena. I was worried about your friend. I'm so sorry, Anduin.
Her eyes, the same sea blue that Anduin had seen in old paintings of Arthas, were filled with sympathy.
I understand that Will asked you not to heal him. As a priest, I know how hard a request that is to honor, especially when it's someone you love.
Thank you. Will was such a constant presence in my life, and in my father's too. I'm ashamed I knew so little about him personally. To me, he was just Will. Anduin paused. You've been with the dying, Kalia. You know that sometimes when people pass, they believe they see their loved ones. She nodded her golden head. Yes, it happens frequently. In his last moments, Will was searching for his wife, Elsie. He looked at her intensely. She was at Lordaeron. Kalia inhaled swiftly.
Oh, she said. And now you're even more determined to make this gathering happen.
I'm absolutely committed to it. My advisors were not exactly happy with the idea, but it's going to happen. He held up both letters. Two letters. One is from the war chief herself. She's accepted. Kalia's face melted into a smile.
Oh, Anduin, I'm so glad.
And the second? From Elsie Benton, the head of the Undercity's Desolate Council. She was Will's wife, and she wants this meeting too. Suddenly Kalia was up out of the chair and throwing her arms around him, laughing delightedly. He laughed a little too, the first laughter that had passed his lips since Will's death. He hugged her back. Kalia was close to Jaina's age, a little bit older. He had missed his aunt, and was glad to have found someone similar in Kalia. She drew back, suddenly realizing what she'd done.
My apologies, Your Majesty. I was just so pleased that no apology needed.
It's good to have someone who, well, who's similar to me in some ways. We both grew up royal children, and we both were called by the light to become priests. If Moira were to drop in now, we could form a club. Anduin regretted mentioning Kalia's former life almost at once. She stiffened and looked down. It was clearly still something she didn't wish to discuss. Before the moment grew awkward, he spoke again, changing the subject. Sylvanas sent along a list of names gathered from all the members of the Desolate Council. I'm wondering, would you like to assist me when I interview these people? They both knew, but Anduin did not say that she would be of particular help, because she might remember some of the Desolate Council from their time as living beings, and she also might recognize some of the names on the Council's list. She nodded.
Of course. I'll be happy to.
Before we get started on the interviews, there's someone I think we should meet, he told Kalia. He'll be here this afternoon.
Oh? Who?
Someone who, I hope, will give us a feel for how the others might respond. Let's call it testing the waters. Frederick Farley was used to providing food, beverages, and entertainment for a crowded inn. He also was used to subsequently breaking up the brawls that often resulted from the combination. He'd cleaned up blood a time or two and had had to expel a few too rowdy individuals from the Lion's Pride Inn, but mostly he simply made people happy. His patrons, be they locals or those just passing through, came to sing songs, tell tales, or sit by the fire with a mug of ale. Sometimes they poured their hearts out to him or his wife, Verena, as they offered a sympathetic ear. What Frederick Farley was not used to was appearing before the King of Stormwind. His first reaction when presented with the summons was terror. He and his wife took pains to run an above-board inn at the Lion's Pride. It had been in the Farley family for years, and had offered brews to thirsty visitors since King Lane's time. Had someone lodged a complaint because of a recent scuffle? Accused them of watering the beer?
Young King Anduin has a kind reputation,
Verena had said, trying to bolster them both.
I can't imagine him throwing you in the stocks or closing our public house. Maybe he wants to talk to you about a private party.
Frederick loved Verena, had since they were both in their early 20s, and now he loved her more than ever.
I think if King Anduin Rin wanted to host a party, he's got a lovely keep to do it in, he said, kissing her forehead lightly. But who knows, right?
The letter the courier presented to him referenced a personal matter, and